Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Yesterday morning, we heard from Mayor de Blasio and Police Commissioner Shea that gun violence is down in the city.
Comparing June of 2021 to June of 2020, shootings down almost 20%, number of victims down over 26%, murders down 23%.
So that bit of relief and encouragement came yesterday morning. But in the afternoon, Governor Cuomo announced he is declaring a disaster emergency on gun violence statewide, citing the statistic that
shootings were up 38% in New York City over the first 6 months compared to 2020.
And the governor mentioned that 26 people were shot over the 4th of July weekend alone, not even counting Monday. So up, down, or sideways, whether you want to look at the decline in shootings in June or the increase compared to last year for the first 6 months as a whole, there is a problem here with especially young men and guns. It's one of the main reasons Eric Adams won the Democratic mayoral primary too, as we've been discussing. And the governor announced short-term and long-term strategies for implementing his state of emergency response, including a jobs program for 21,000 young New Yorkers. With us now are three authors of a field research report published last year that dug into the reasons why young men carry guns in the hopes that they can shed some light into why the use of guns has escalated and maybe what can be done about it. We'll hear their findings and get reaction to the mayor and the governor. The Center for Court Innovation is the group that released the report, and it's titled Gotta Make Your Own Heaven, Guns, Safety, and the Edge of Adulthood in New York City. And to talk about their findings and recommendations and react to the news, we're joined by the research director, Rachel Swanner, at the Center for Court Innovation, their deputy research director, Elise White, and Basim Spate, a community-based research coordinator. So welcome back to the show, Rachel Swanner and Elise White, and welcome, Basim Spate. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Happy to be here.
Good morning.
Rachel Swanner, this study, we should say, doesn't look at how many kids in the city are carrying guns, but the reasons they do?
Right. So we talked to 330 people, young people ages 16 to 24, in three different neighborhoods in New York City that had high levels of gun violence. So Morrisania in the Bronx, Brownsville in Brooklyn, and East Harlem in Manhattan. And we wanted to know, gun violence is increasing in cities, and it's often attributed to youth gang conflicts. And young folks are often the primary victims and perpetrators. So we wanted to try to understand, what are the reasons young people are carrying guns? What are their social networks like? And what roles do guns play in these networks?
And Elise White, who exactly did you try to reach in your interviews, and what were you asking them?
So we wanted to look specifically at 16 to 24-year-olds because we know that that's the age range when gun use typically peaks. And we were asking them a wide variety of questions. So we, in most of the research that exists, it focuses on either white suburban gun carrying, or if it looks at all at inner city or urban gun use in black and brown communities, it's extremely old. Or it has a very small sample size. So what we did is we wanted to talk to young people who had carried a gun in the last year and find out from them what are the drivers. So not just look at specific crime patterns or look at specific, gang interaction patterns, but really how do their lives function generally speaking? What are their interactions with institutions, structures of power around them? And how do these play out and express themselves in their decisions or their need to carry a gun for safety and survival?
And Basim Spate, you were one of the people who conducted the interviews. Your own background contributed to your doing that effectively, from what I see. Do you want to share some of your own story to introduce yourself to our listeners and how you came to approach these interviews?
Yes. My experience is my family history of gun violence. I lost some friends, my father and two brothers to gun violence. And then my experience just growing up in the foster system and getting involved in the streets and with with gangs, you know, across the city and across other states, where it gave me a clear foundation and experience and knowledge on how these things operate, right? So I really got into this work during Cure Violence, working for SOS. Well, SOS part of the Cure Violence model. And there I stopped a lot of shootings and stopped a lot of retaliations and done a lot of mediation. So that's where I gained a lot of my skill sets. But there I was able to meet Rachel there. She was bringing in a survey around this topic that we're talking about now. And I was helping her with giving her feedback on this survey, helping rephrase questions, personal questions, or how to ask gang-involved individuals. And then we then broke that down and went outside and broke out what areas would be best where high gun violence is taking place. And then I joined the project and came on as security. And then from there, I just started training to do interviews and became part of the research team. So what really got me into this work, because I never had noticed or any research had never been done like this before, especially around gun violence. And then it also gives you the power to control your narrative, right? Because I'm able to go out there with my experience and maybe talk down and sit down and talk with individuals and engage and have these conversations because we relate, because we have those experiences. But when I say controlling narratives, it means that it gives me the power to control the data and then sit down with Elise and them and put this data together and present this data. And not saying that, and then it also gives us the experience to say that instead of people who don't really know our experience telling the world our stories,
yes,
and what they think our solution should be.
Well, let me ask you about one thing. To start getting into the content of that, I should tell our listeners that this research was done before the pandemic, shortly before the pandemic. And we all know we've seen a big spike in gun violence in New York and elsewhere that started during the pandemic. Does what you learned in the research tell you anything about why we saw this spike of shootings during lockdown?
Yes, very much so. It exposed more. Like, what they experience on a daily sources, lack of education. And when we talk to these young men and women, these are the things that they want, but there's also like a thing of an invisible wall of access being denied to them. And with the pandemic, everything that's shutting down, so we shut down schools, kids couldn't travel. Mainly kids go to school to eat, you know what I'm saying? And to express themselves, just to get out whatever's going on in their home or in their neighborhood. But now all that's shut down and people are not working. People can barely pay their bills, barely can put food in their house. And it makes people come outside and people can't go nowhere because they're trapped in this one neighborhood. So, of course, all these things, it's going to escalate. And then within that pandemic, we had nothing to sent in there because everything was new, you know, the pandemic shut down the world. So it was new to everybody and scary at the same time. But then it just added on top of what these neighborhoods are experiencing already on a daily, such as oppression, harassment, and these sort of things. So with that happening, yes, we was going to see a rise in crime and rising and a lot of things that we have witnessed already.
Rachel, do you want to add to that? What did you find in the study were the main drivers of gun use among mostly these young men?
Yes, yeah, so I mentioned that we talked to 333 participants ages 16 to 24, and I do want to just say that 79% were men, so the majority were men, but we did have 21% women. But youth in our study were mostly caring to increase their feelings of safety. Violence was a near universal experience among the young people we interviewed. So 81% had been shot or shot at. 88% had had a friend or family member shot. 70% had witnessed someone getting shot. 67% had been attacked with a different weapon, like a knife or a bat. So they held a widespread belief that they could be victimized at any time, and guns served to protect them from real or perceived threats from other gun carriers. So rival gang members, residents of different housing developments, and the police. And they didn't feel the police protected them from any of it. So given these realities, the hypervigilance that seems apparent in so many of their narratives is kind of constructively can be understood as a trauma reaction in a causal relationship to the death and threat of death they live with daily. And gun carrying served as one mechanism of self-preservation. And so, as Basim was saying, during the pandemic, a lot of these institutions that, you know, gave them some support shut down completely. And so it's all of these things, their violence, their trauma was activated because of just not knowing what was going to happen. And again, feeling like they were experiencing community trauma, being left behind, not being protected, not being cared about. You know, a lot of these communities were disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 as well.
And Elise White, do you want to elaborate on that idea that people are carrying guns for safety as they see it, as opposed to for aggression? I think that might be the opposite of what a lot of other people assume.
Absolutely. So what we heard over and over again from participants is a sense of complete institutional abandonment, right? So they're lacking any pathway to survival in the mainstream economy, through the education system. They're not protected by policing institutions and, in fact, are targeted. Often that's their feeling. Their feeling is that they are under attack and that they're being targeted by police. And there really is no emotional or social service support network for these young people specifically. We know that there are a lot of great organizations that provide really important and meaningful services to young people in poor neighborhoods and neighborhoods where most of the residents are people of color. But these specific subset of young people are generally very seldom reached. So they're on their own. They are, and so the gangs can be understood as a structure often for them, and Basim can certainly speak to this, of emotional support, of economic support and safety, and certainly safety in the streets. So for them, they, over and over again, and this absolutely has been exacerbated by the pandemic, they feel that they don't know who to trust and they don't know who potentially could come at them. So at any moment, they feel something could come, something could happen. They could be shot. They could be stabbed. And this is because this isn't just, you know, like a general sense of paranoia. This is based in lived reality. So this is, as Rachel mentioned with statistics, they know so many people who have been shot, so many people who have been killed. These are friends. These are family members. These are neighbors. And so for them, right, so if they feel that the police engage with them in a militaristic fashion, engage them in sort of a warlike context, and are not a source of safety or protection, they have very few options, frankly. And so they see the gun carrying as a means to survival. You hear it over and over and over again. And actually, mm-hmm. some of the questions that we asked asked about self-defense. And self-defense, the mechanism they mentioned over and over again was carrying the gun.
And listeners, we might be able to take, in our limited time, a few phone calls with questions or even your own stories for our guests. The authors of the Center for Court Innovations report titled Gotta Make Your Own Heaven, Guns, Safety, and the Edge of Adulthood in New York City, Research Director Rachel Swanner, Deputy Research Director Elise White, and Basim Spade, Community-Based Research Coordinator for the Center for Court Innovation, 646-435-7280, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. And Basim, I'm going to invite you to continue on that same thread, because it seems like we're hearing about a sort of which came first, the chicken or the egg effect with respect to carrying weapons. If they don't trust the police and fear violence at the hands of police or other civilians, so by carrying guns, they feel more safe, but then they also wind up drawing the attention of the police as a result, and there's the risk of more shootings taking place because there are more guns.
Right. We could go back to what Elise was saying, just the protection of it all, not being like forgotten by the government and these institutes, or just witnessing the military fashion of the police on a daily. So through that, they feel like they're alone. So with that, with the neglect of them feeling alone, you have these organizations that are formed or these networks that are formed and then labeled as gangs, right? But when we sat down and talked to them, our data says that 88% have been in gangs, 66% were still active. The reasoning for joining gangs was protection was the number one primary reason. Family history of gang involvement or people was born into it. Gangs serving as a family, providing love and emotional support. Gangs also providing material support, such as money, access ways to make money, food and housing. Gangs was also described as having a complex role in communities, such as positive aspects and negative aspects, right? But what our data, what they had told us are the positive aspects of these gangs was providing support for children and adults in their communities where other resources and institutes was not doing that. Things like clothing, backpacks, school supplies, and foods. These gangs also organized community events like basketball tournaments, cookout, food drives, and block cleanups. They also talked about the services of neighborhoods that has mistrust and a feeling that they could be victimized at any time. And so we're talking about just a generalized fear that hovers these neighborhoods on a daily, right? Needing a protection from people seeking retaliation and more localized fear, fear of being shot by the police. They also didn't feel protected by the police. So the guns was framed as a self-defense and self-preservation, right? Guns used, they also spoke that 78% reported that they felt safe when carrying a gun.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot. 63 yeah. felt safe when they're not carrying. So they felt like they were between a rock and a hard place, unprotected from other gun users, but like not protected by the police, while simultaneously being punished for self-protecting by being punished for carrying guns for their protection. So many of us talked about the exercising the restraint when it comes to gun use and only using it when they felt like it was absolutely necessary.
Rachel, on what Basim just said about carrying, merely carrying for safety,
mm-hmm.
and for you as research director of the group that's called the Center for Court Innovation, the winner of the Manhattan mm-hmm. DA primary, Alvin Bragg, who obviously would work in court, and he'll be a guest here tomorrow, he says on his campaign website, violence and crime are often rooted in a sense of injustice and distrust of the government. The same thing mm-hmm. you've all been saying. The traditional response by law enforcement to crime is greater police presence, crackdowns, and shows of force, he writes, which only then serve to reinforce distrust and discontent in the community. Thousands of lives are shattered by violence or incarceration, further weakening the community socially and economically, continuing the spiral. So Bragg proposes a multifaceted plan of social in addition to law enforcement approaches. And here's the thing I want to ask you about. At the prosecution level, Bragg says, we will do away with the most common outcome in current gun prosecutions, 1 to 3 year jail or prison sentences for the possession of a firearm. He says mere possession cases are the most commonly prosecuted gun offense. Clearly, those firearm possession cases associated with a specific incident of violence are and should be treated differently. But these cases of possession alone do not meaningfully incapacitate those who truly drive gun violence. They force those who are not drivers of violence onto a path that almost inexorably leads to recidivism. Does anything in the Center for Court Innovation's work back up or refute that theory?
That's a great question. You know, I think around locking people up for gun carrying, and I think he's right. You know, there's plenty of research out there that shows that locking up fewer people is going to make us safer. You know, you compare people similar, like released and detained before trial studies in New York, in Miami, in Philadelphia, Houston, and it consistently links detention, being in jail, in prison, in a juvenile detention center with a modestly greater risk of reoffending once that period is over. So incarceration has well-known criminogenic effects, like disrupting people's family and work lives, including their long-term earning potential, along with access to housing and any treatment that they might be receiving. and exposing them to dehumanizing and traumatizing effects of jail. I know that we've been working on trying to work to close Rikers Island, which is notorious for having violence and people being traumatized by their experience there. So being locked up isn't going to make us safer. It's going to increase people's criminogenic risk. So that is true.
Let me get a caller in here. Dominique in Bushwick. You're on WNYC. Hi, Dominique.
Hi there. So nice to be with you all. I'm just wanting to come on and kind of express as a Black woman how I feel about all this. I really appreciate the talk about support and how, lack of resources is what kind of ends up happening. So if people in communities where violence happens feel supported, if they feel housed, if they feel fed, if they feel like police are not going to come for no reason to their communities, harass them, harm them, kill them. If those things were true, then we would not really be dealing with the rock in the hard place that was being talked about, But since those things are not true, since the baseline of people's needs are not being met, what are you going to do? The folks that kind of talk about gun violence as, scary, obviously scary, but, aggressive, or these people are wild and they don't know how to do things in their life and blah, blah, blah. They've never been in a situation where this is the choice. Excuse me raising my voice, but, this is really, it's a means to, it's life or death, quite literally. So that's what I have to say. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be able to say that to people. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Please call us again. Anna Maria in Lower Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Anna Maria.
Oh, hi. Yes. Good morning. I'm sorry. I'm just coming out of the train. Yes, I totally disagree with what the guest is saying about that it is the fault of COVID because it's everybody's fault. But I don't see that. What I see is all these kids shooting randomly to anyone and for anything. And then it's everybody's fault. But what about the parents, They never come up in this research, the parent. Parent has to be responsible for the kids that you decided to have. Like I said before, I have a grandchild that he's 16 years old. And when he goes out, I say to him, when you go out, you try to avoid as much as you can. If something come out, walk away, call the police. Why? Because once you get in trouble, your life is going to be damaged forever. You will never be able to work. You will never be able to do this because when you have a record, that's it. You are done. And the last thing that I want to say is a lot of these the young people, they have very expensive tastes. They like this very expensive sneakers, the drinks, the phone, and all that. And they don't do good in school. And then what is there for them to have all these things?
Anna Maria, thank you for your call. Basim, what are you thinking, listening to those two calls, contrasting calls?
I'm going to actually let Elise handle this one.
Okay.
She's best at answering.
All right. Elise White, Deputy Research Director for the Center for Court Innovation. Want to take it?
Sure. So it's an interesting back-to-back. I think that our data... What I can say is this. Our data definitely indicates that young people are not shooting randomly. So it might look random from the outside, but they are making very calculated decisions about when and how it happens, if it has to happen. They are very aware. And we talked to 330 gun carriers. So this isn't, I do want to be clear about this. This is a very large sample for this kind of in-depth interview. They are very aware of their own mortality, and they're very aware that they are holding someone else's life in their hands. And so when they enter the decision to pull a trigger, that is what they're holding. So a much better analogy than wild kids in the street out of control is a soldier, and the kinds of trauma that they carry as a result of that are very similar to veterans who have been in combat. And I think that's why you see substance use at the rates that you do in the same way that you see, you see it in veterans. There's a self-medication. There's a self-preservation. There's an effort to
You know, when we interviewed about this, so we have data on this. They are using substances in an effort to help them manage affect because of trauma.
We only have a minute left in the segment, and Basim, I don't know if you've seen the governor's plan introduced yesterday in conjunction with his state of emergency, first state in the country to declare a gun violence state of emergency. And he says by treating gun violence as a public health emergency, as they treated COVID, meaning both short-term and long-term strategies, we can get gun violence more under control. And one centerpiece program the governor announced is a $57 million budget to create 21,000 jobs for young New Yorkers. And I'm just curious if you want to react to that at all. Do you see a direct connection between that and short-term reductions in shootings?
Yeah, I believe in services. I believe in services. But when we say 21,000 jobs, what type of jobs are we talking about? Are we talking about jobs that they can be in and it could be a career-wise job so they could be successful and able to purchase a home and able to buy food and able to take care of their children so they don't have to live in this daily, what we talked about, war-torn areas where they have to experience this trauma on a daily and feel left out and abandoned and neglected so they can't really concentrate on their true focus and their goals of how to be successful in life because they always deny these services that we constantly keep talking about or these resources to help them defer from that, right? So for me, any services that we are talking about that could bring to help these neighborhoods and get them out of what we are talking about or what we are spending all this money towards to, because at the end of the day, like if we're talking about services and how to get them out and whatnot and jobs to help their families and stuff like that, then that's okay. But if we're talking about alternatives of imprisonment and how to criminalize them, that's not a solution for us. And our data does not present that.
Basim Speight, Research Coordinator. Rachel Swanner, Research Director. Elise White, Deputy Research Director of the Center for Court Innovation. Their report is titled, Gotta Make Your Own Heaven, Guns, Safety, and the Edge of Adulthood in New York City. Thank you all three of us for sharing your time and your expertise with us.
Thank you for having us.